today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
But notice this phrase in verse 1. It's absolutely critical. It says, who will secretly bring in destructive heresies. I want you to notice, it's a very basic point, but it bears our attention. False teachers work secretly. It isn't that their teaching is so secret. They want their teaching to be as public and as popular as possible. They want to get as many people to listen to their teaching. No, it's not their teaching itself that's secret, but it's the false nature, the deceptive nature of their teaching is hidden.
We hear about a lot of preachers and teachers today that just aren't teaching God's truth. It can be frustrating to know that these men and women are out there taking advantage of our brothers and sisters. This isn't something unique to our age, however. The Apostle Peter had to deal with them too. He addresses them in 2 Peter. Pastor David will be teaching about their danger and, more importantly, how to recognize when someone is not teaching the truth. Now, here's Pastor David with part one of his message, The Rise and Fall of False Prophets.
Chapter 2, let's look at the first verse and I'll sort of set the context. We read, but there were also false prophets among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you, who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the Lord who bought them, and bring on themselves swift destruction. At the end of 2 Peter chapter 1, Peter spoke to us about holy men of God who were prophets and who spoke as the Holy Spirit moved them. Now Peter's bringing in the alternative thought. Not only were there holy men of God who were moved with the gift of prophecy, there were also false prophets that needed to be understood and dealt with. So he says right there in verse 1, notice it again, but there were also false prophets. And then he also mentions false teachers. Now this was true both in Peter's day and our own. By the way, when you see false prophets and false teachers in the church today, it should be at least a small comfort for you that they were in the very first church as well. This goes all the way back to apostolic times. If we somehow imagine a time when the church was so pure that there were never false prophets or false teachers in its midst, you're never going to have such a time. All the way back from the time of the apostles itself. But notice this phrase in verse 1. It's absolutely critical. It says, who will secretly bring in destructive heresies. I want you to notice, it's a very basic point, but it bears our attention. False teachers work secretly. It isn't that their teaching is so secret. They want their teaching to be as public and as popular as possible. They want to get as many people to listen to their teaching. No, it's not their teaching itself that's secret, but it's the false nature, the deceptive nature of their teaching is hidden. Can I just give you a principle here? No false teacher ever announces themselves as a false teacher. They're not making t-shirts that say, I'm a false teacher. Every false teacher usually thinks of themselves as being sincere and being right and being perfectly on point. But no, they are, notice, who will secretly bring in destructive heresies. They destroy by telling lies about Jesus Christ and his work for us and in us. Now, when I say lies, that might sound like a strong term, because this is what I want you to understand. In the mind, and maybe even in the voice of the false teacher, it doesn't seem like a lie. It's an error. But an error that is harmful enough can be considered a lie. And by these heresies, people are hurt and destroyed. Notice the phrase he uses, destructive heresies. Here's another little tagline for you. The first one is, no false teacher announces himself as a false teacher. The second tagline for you is this, is that heresy isn't harmless. In the thinking of our modern age, heresy is absolutely harmless. You think God is the God of the Bible, and you over here, you think God is a great big pizza or something like that. The way most people think, who cares? Who cares about what your ideas about God and eternity and spiritual things and eternal truth are all about? That's the thinking of our modern age. But ladies and gentlemen, if there really is a God, and I'm not saying that to call that into question, but I'm just establishing that proposition. If there truly is a God, then how we regard that God is absolutely important. Because we want to worship, we want to relate, we want to connect to the God who is really there, the true God. And for us, of course, we understand this to be the God revealed by the Bible. I want you to notice something. False prophets secretly bring in destructive heresies. Notice the phrase here in verse 1, even denying the Lord who bought them. False teachers deny the Lord who bought them. In this, Peter says that at the very least, these people appear to be saved. Now, it's kind of interesting, both in the beginning of 2 Peter chapter 2 and at the end of 2 Peter chapter 2, we have passages or lines or verses that seem to deal with this issue of, can a person lose their salvation? And it is not my intention to go into an in-depth discussion of that debate this evening. But I do just want to point something out here. When Peter says, even denying, who's denying? The false teachers are denying. The false teachers are denying the Lord who bought them. There is some sense in which these are bought people by Jesus Christ. Otherwise, Peter would never say that the Lord bought them. But at the same time, they are false, destructive teachers. Here's the takeaway. Just get out of your mind for a moment the debate whether or not a person can lose their salvation. Just get that out of your mind for a moment. Take what you positively can say from this. You can say this, that even a person who appears to have a godly walk and relationship with Jesus Christ, they can still bring in destructive heresies. You could look at a brother or a sister. The Lord bought them, you'd say. Man, the Lord bought them. They belong to the Lord. That person still has the capability to bring in destructive heresies, false teachings. So you don't judge the teaching primarily by the character of the person involved in it. I'm not saying the character makes no difference, and Peter's going to speak to the character later on. But someone who appears to have a blood-bought life can still bring in destructive heresies. Matter of fact, let me say this. Oftentimes, good men who teach lies do the worst damage because their lies are believed because of the goodness of their life. But what do these people do? Notice at the end of verse 1, they bring on themselves swift destruction. Peter's going to speak more about that in a moment, so I'll just let that. But they bring on themselves. That's what these false prophets, false teachers do. They bring on themselves swift destruction. Now verse 2. And many will follow their destructive ways, because of whom the way of truth will be blasphemed. Let that phrase get impressed upon your mind. Right there in verse 2. Many will follow their destructive ways. Who's going to follow? Many. Not just a few, many. Now, it's very easy for us in the Christian world to get very worked up over the number of people who follow false teachings. Sometimes they are false teachings that are easily understood to be false. Groups with completely wrong ideas about who Jesus is, such as the Mormons or Latter-day Saints and Jehovah's Witnesses. And I'm sorry if that's kind of like a bombshell before you. You may have had no knowledge of it, but I'm just telling you, the Jesus that is preached by the Mormons or Latter-day Saints and the Jesus that is preached by Jehovah's Witnesses, it's not the Jesus of the Bible. It's a distorted Jesus, and so seriously distorted that we would regard it as a false teaching. So some of those are easy to understand. There's other things that are just very significant twistings of doctrine and practice, something like the prosperity gospel or the health and wealth gospel that's sometimes said, is that God's whole point of work in your life is to make you rich and perfectly healthy. And if you're not rich and if you're not perfectly healthy, you are out of God's will, so just get into faith, brother or sister. We understand those things. Now, we may get frustrated that those or perhaps other strange teachings get a big, large following. I want you to know this is exactly what Peter said would happen. Should we read again? Look at verse 2. Many will follow their destructive ways. And I have to say, to me, this is a marvel. It's not strange that there are false teachers. There's always weirdos out there trying to get a following. What is strange is how often false teachers are accepted and embraced by the Christian community. It shows that there is an alarming ignorance of God's word, and people who are persuasive and people who are sincere can convince people of things that aren't biblically true. And because of these people, look at verse 2 again, because of whom the way of truth will be blasphemed. When false teachers are at work and when crowds are following, the way of truth is blasphemed. God's holy name and honor are disgraced. I remember a friend telling me the story, and I don't doubt him. He was watching on television, but the way he shared it was so meaningful. But I don't want to imply that I saw it myself, but shared from a good friend of mine. He's watching on TV a crusade of one of these flamboyant healing evangelists, you know, the kind of guy who just, wow, everybody's healed. Wow, everybody falls down. Wow, this is amazing. And he said, you could see off on one side of the platform, there's a whole row of people in wheelchairs. And you know why the wheelchair people are there? Man, they came to get healed. You or I, we might want to get healed of our hangnail or our bad breath or whatever it is. These people, look, it's everything. And these people were utterly ignored by the evangelist, as many of them were struggling to stand up from their wheelchairs. And the whole scene was just so lost, so sad, so filled with a darkness that had nothing to do with the nature of Jesus Christ. You could see what Peter says. Look at it right here in verse 2. Because of whom the way of truth will be blasphemed. Now, verse 3. But by covetousness, they will exploit you with deceptive words. For a long time, their judgment has not been idle, and their destruction does not slumber. These false teachers use covetousness. Both their own covetousness they use, but they also use covetousness in the life of the people they attract. Mr. Prosperity Teacher out there, what is he doing? Well, he's covetous. He wants the private jet or the fancy cars or the mansions or whatever it is. And by the way, some of these prosperity guys are fabulously wealthy, almost incomprehensibly so. In any regard, they are covetous, but there's also covetousness that they cultivate in the people they preach to. They want people to have the same covetousness. So they say, by covetousness, they will exploit you with deceptive words. For a long time, their judgment has not been idle and their destruction does not slumber. Peter assures us that false teachers will be judged. Even though they seem to prosper for the present time, their judgment is not idle. It's not on pause. God's wrath pours out upon them. And let me give you one way that God's wrath pours out upon them. So sometimes you get frustrated with false teachers in the church. You look at, God, why do you just strike this guy down? God, you could do it so easily. Why don't you just do it? I'll tell you. Because God's judgment is working upon those men and women even at the present moment. What do I mean by that? Every day that God allows them to go on in their corruption, they are heaping more and more judgment upon themselves. Listen, if God was being loving and merciful to them instead of judging, he'd stop them right then. But by even allowing them to go on and heap a greater and greater judgment upon themselves, God is expressing his judgment against them. Starting at verse 4 begins a section that expresses God's care for both the unrighteous and the righteous. And what do I mean by care? God knows what to do with the unrighteous and the righteous. Look here at verse 4. He says, for if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in on the flood the world of the ungodly, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemning them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly. Right here in verses 4, 5, and 6, Peter gives us three examples of God's judgment upon the ungodly. What's the first example? Look at verse 4. If God did not spare the angels who sinned, God judged wicked angels, setting them in chains of darkness. Which, by the way, that's a powerful literary phrase. What are chains of darkness? I don't know, but it sounds terrible. He put them in chains of darkness. Doing what? Notice here, they are waiting, reserved for judgment. Now, apparently, Some fallen angels are bound, chains of darkness, and others are active upon the earth and perhaps in the heavens as demons. Now, it is clear that at some time in history or eternity past, angelic beings had a period of choosing and testing regarding their future destiny. Just like you and I right now, is this lifetime not our time for choosing? God gives us as human beings the dignified choice right now, heaven or hell. This is your choice. Follow Jesus or reject him. Love God or push him away. Now is our time of choice. And we understand, don't we, as humans, from what the Bible tells us, that once we pass from this life to the next, the time of choosing is over. Whatever you chose in this season is set in stone for all of eternity once you pass from this life to the next. Now, apparently, the angels have already had their time of choosing. And now their fate is set in stone. But of those fallen angels, some of them are bound, some of them are free. Now, we can't conclusively say why and when the angels fell. I'm prepared to go off on a long digression of this that I personally would find very satisfying and interesting. But let me just say, we don't know for certain why and when the angels rebelled. And we also do not know if Peter's reference here is to the original fall of the angelic host, or if his reference is to some particular sinning angels in the days of Noah, which he's going to mention just in the following verses. That brings up a whole nother issue that I'm not going to get into here this evening. What's the point? The reason why I'm not getting into it is I just want you to notice these sinning angels, even though it's fascinating, aren't we fascinated talking about these things? Forget about 20 minutes. We could spend a couple weeks talking about this and it would be interesting. But these sinning angels are one of three examples. Do you get that in what Peter just said? What are the three examples? The sinning angels, the world in Noah's day, and Sodom and Gomorrah. So we don't want to get too hung up on the first example because it's the totality of the three that are teaching us the message. Right now, this is just what you have to grab a hold of. Sinning, there were angels who sinned and God judged them. Got it? Now verse 4. He cast them down to hell, delivered them into chains of darkness. They're put into that place there, verse 4. Now in verse 5, God did not spare the ancient world. This speaks of the world before Noah's flood. Notice this. It says in Genesis 6:5 that because the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth and every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. That is a world ripe for judgment. By the way, it hits a little bit too close to home with our present age. But that describes the world before the flood, the world before judgment. The whole earth was this wicked. Therefore, God sent such a dramatic judgment as is described in the scriptures having to do with the flood. So, angels sinned and were judged. The world before the flood sinned and was judged by the flood. Now, verse 6, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them to destruction. God judged the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, making them an example of his judgment. Notice Genesis 18, verse 20, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great and because their sin is very grave indeed. Notice the last phrase here of verse 6, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly. Peter, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, puts forth these three examples to warn the ungodly, and may I say it, to warn us as well. If you are ungodly, let it be a warning to you, and you're welcome here this evening. The godly are welcome here too, and we can all learn from this. Notice this. The angels had a place of high status and privilege, did they not? These are angels. These are in the presence of God. In the days of the flood, everybody was bad. Everybody. It wasn't just a few bad and a few good. Everybody was bad. God preserved how many in the days of the flood? Only 8 from the population of the entire earth. So virtually the entire earth was corrupt. They were all bad. The angels fell from a very high place. Before the flood, everybody was bad, and Sodom and Gomorrah were very prosperous, fertile places. The way it's described in the book of Genesis, the regions of Sodom and Gomorrah before God judged them, was that the ground was lush. It was like the Garden of Eden. I mean, it was prosperous for an agricultural society. Okay, so get this. What's the lesson we learn from them? Friends, this is pretty dramatic. God judged the angels who sinned, so no one is too high to be judged. Isn't that evident? You think you're so high and mighty? Oh, but let me tell you about my spiritual experiences. No, nobody's too high to be judged. Secondly, God judged the ancient world before the flood, so God doesn't grade on a curve. He doesn't compare man among other men. You say, well, we're all bad, God. You can't judge me. God says, no, you're right. You are all bad. I'm judging you all. You can't excuse yourself because you're the least wicked among a bunch of wicked people. That doesn't fly with God. No. God doesn't grade on a curve, so to speak. And then thirdly, God judged Sodom and Gomorrah so even the prosperous can be judged. Were they not prosperous in Sodom and Gomorrah? Of course they were. And don't many people think that way? I'm making my way in this world. I'm doing pretty well. Business is good. And congratulations if business is good. It's tough having business good in the world today. So if business is good for you, well, I'm very happy for you. But don't think that that makes you so high and so secure that you're beyond the reach of God's judgment. That's what these three examples of judgment show us. Therefore, the ungodly have no reason to think that they can escape God's judgment. Their coming judgment is certain. Now, we have the certainty of God dealing with the ungodly. Now look at, starting at verse 7, we also have the certainty of the righteous and their deliverance. Verse 7, and delivered righteous Lot. I had trouble saying righteous Lot, but it's right there in the text. And delivered righteous Lot, who is oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked, for that righteous man dwelling among them tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. Then the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations and to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment. If God knows how to deal with the wicked, he knows how to set them up for judgment. Okay, we're okay with that. He also knows how to deliver the righteous. And who's his example of knowing how to deliver the righteous? Lot. Now, I don't know what you know about Lot from the Old Testament. I don't have time to do an in-depth study in this. But let me just say, from reading the story of Lot in the Old Testament, you would not immediately jump to the conclusion that he was a righteous man. As a matter of fact, Lot is often used by preacher guys like myself as the ultimate of the compromising, carnal man who by stages gets more and more worldly and is in the end saved, but by the skin of his teeth, and yet he lost everything because of his compromising carnal ways. That's how we preacher men regard Lot. And I think rightfully so from the Genesis story. If I was teaching the story of Lot from Genesis, you better believe that's how I teach it. But I find wonderful comfort in the fact that Peter looks at Lot and, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, says, righteous Lot. Matter of fact, he calls him righteous twice in those verses, does he not? Just in case you missed it the first time, he calls him righteous a second time. I find great comfort in this.
We're so glad you joined us today on Enduring Word. Pastor David's study through the book of 2 Peter continues to reveal the need for God's people to be rooted deeply in his word, especially when others try to lead us astray. We hope the words you heard today have blessed you and encouraged you today. There's much more we'd like to share with you at our website, enduringword.com. There you'll find previous messages by Pastor David free to listen to or download. You can also subscribe to our Enduring Word radio podcast. In this busy world, it can be difficult to set aside time to study the Bible in depth. By subscribing to our podcast, you'll have sound, biblical teachings with you on the go, right on your smartphone, tablet, or computer. Find a link to our podcasts under the Media tab at enduringword.com. Right now, we'd like to take a moment to tell you how you can get involved in this ministry. Programs like this are valuable ministry tools that God uses to expand His kingdom here on earth. And we feel so blessed to be a part of that with Enduring Word. As with any ministry, though, there are significant costs involved. Would you prayerfully consider supporting the ministry of Enduring Word financially? You can find out more by visiting enduringword.com and clicking on Donate. Thanks for keeping us in your prayers, and thanks for listening today. Be sure to tune in again as Pastor David presents more from the book of 2 Peter, right here on Enduring Word.